You're listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Auto D Show here on Dave Pratt's Star Worldwide Network Studios, broadcasting from high above Camelback Road in beautiful Scottsdale, Arizona. I am your host, Otto Daniolo, and this evening, my guest is Michael Jason Allen, a man of music and film, and martial arts, actually, I'm just learning. He's won Best Arizona Actor in the Jerome Film Festival, and one of his films won Best Picture in the Great Lakes Film Festival. With details on these awards and others as well, as his work in music, Jason will be joining me right after this tune called Number 92 from the Fervor Records catalog, written and performed by Super Stereo here in the Auto D Show. Check it out.
Listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
Brought to you by the third annual Fervor Music Biz Summit, where a slew of top industry experts create an unforgettable day of learning and community. The 2020 Summit features top Los Angeles film and TV music supervisors, clearance consultants, and marketing strategists discussing what it takes to break through and develop a meaningful career in the music business. The third annual Fervor Music Biz Summit is April 4th in the main auditorium at the Glendale Library. Information is on the web at fervormusicbizsummit.com. That's fervormusicbizsummit.com. And that was number 92 by Super Stereo here in the Auto D Show, which is brought to you tonight by the third annual Fervor Music Biz Summit, which I think you just heard a spot for, which is happening April 4th in the main auditorium at the Glendale Library. And as mentioned, for more info, check out the Fervor Music Biz Summit .com website. That's F-E-R-V-O-R music B-I-Z summit.com. It is free, but you've got to register first to attend, so be sure to check it out. And the last 2 years, it has really been a cool event. This year, I'm going to be out there as well, moderating one of the conversations, one of the panels, and interviewing another guest that's going to be there this year. So it's going to be a lot of fun. Come on out and say hello. And if you are a music creator, rights owner, or a music publisher, and you haven't done a lot of placement in TV and film with your masters, this is a great opportunity for you to talk to the guys who make those decisions for a lot of network shows. So there, it's been said, be there. And right now, I guess I'd like to introduce my guest, bring him on the show. And that is singer, songwriter, and filmmaker, Michael Jason Allen. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Thank you, Otto.
Now, I mentioned your full name, and I already called you Michael, and then I corrected myself and said, Jason, you prefer to go by Jason.
This is what I've went by my whole life, yeah.
Okay, so where's all this Michael Jason Allen come from?
Well, I'm born Michael Jason Allen. That's my real name, all three first names, basically. But yeah, that's my real name, and you know, my dad wanted me to be named Jason Michael Allen because my parents both knew that I was going to be called Jason my whole life, you know, but my mother said it sounded better the other way around. So that has been giving me problems my whole life because my legal name is Michael Allen, but they always called me Jason since the day I was born. So uh-huh. That's the only thing I answer. Someone says Michael, I don't look, I don't right. know, you know, but so I go by all three names because of that. But there's another reason why, is because in the filmmaking world, there's something called IMDb. It's a website. Mm-hmm. It's a website of films and movies and actors and things. And if you go on IMDb and you look up Jason Allen, there's about 46 or 48, 47 of them.
Right.
And then if you do Michael Allen only, then there's almost 100. I think there's 80-something last time I checked.
Okay.
And then there's a couple of famous people named Jason Allen. There's a player for the Miami Dolphins, and there was a senator from Michigan or something. So if I use all three names on IMDb in the acting world, I'm the only one.
There you go.
So that's why I do it.
At least people can find you.
Yes, but I do go by Jason.
The other guys need to use some middle names.
Well, I don't do it to be pretentious of my name. You know, a lot of people, they think it's the cool thing to use three names, mm-hmm. you know, if you're a performer.
Well, it is if you're like a famous murderer.
If you're a murderer, yeah. You know, John Wayne Gacy or Rodney John James Wilkes Alcala.
Booth. Yeah, they all have those. David, you know, Mark David Chapman, whatever. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of, they kind of do that. Lee Harvey Oswald, and Sirhan, they're all that way.
Yes.
Except Sirhan Sirhan, unless he had a middle name. But no one can remember.
It's probably Sirhan, too.
There you go. Yeah, exactly. And we digress. But anyway, you know, you mentioned film, and you've done a bunch of movies. And I want to say, for independent productions done all kind of a, talk about a one-man band. You're like a one-man production company where you write, you direct, you act, you edit, you do the music, you do it all. Watching all the trailers to your films, they look incredible for being a one-man show. Because usually, you know, it takes a heck of a lot. That's why all those names are on those credits. It takes a heck of a lot of people with a lot of different disciplines to really pull it off. So I can't wait to watch some of your films that I've seen the trailers for, because they really, really look great. And before we get into some of the movies and what they're all about, how did you get into film? I mean, did you go to film school, for example, or study film at all?
No, what happened is, back in the 90s, I bought a home video camera like everyone else did, you know, the VHS over your shoulder mm-hmm. type, and tried to make a little martial arts movie in the backyard, you know, like everyone mm-hmm. else does when you're kids. But then I came to Arizona in the spring of 99, and I saw something in the New Times magazine that said extras wanted in a movie, so I went and checked it out, and it was kind of a scam. You know, you go to this agency, they make you buy a bunch of pictures and all that stuff, but at the same time they did get me into a movie, and they got me into some commercials, so it was actually worth it for me, you know, to uh-huh. do. But I got the bug. I did my first movie. It was actually a major film by Columbia Pictures, and my first scene I ever did in front of a camera was with John Goodman and Annette Bening and Greg Kinnear. All three.
Oh my God, you're kidding
yeah,
me.
Yeah, it was awesome. And I was just an extra. I was an extra. I was nobody. But right. still, it was my first day
what
being
movie
on set with these
guys.
It's called What Planet Are You From?
Okay.
It was actually filmed in Phoenix. Okay. And it also had Ben Kingsley in it, and it had lot of other people in it, cameos of a lot of other actors, Jeanine Garofalo and all kinds of people. But yeah, that was my first one. I worked 2 days on that. I got a check for like $80-something, mm-hmm. and it was awesome. And I was like, wow, this is cool. So I just kind of did little things here and there. And then 2008 rolled around, and you know, in the meantime, I was acting in other people's movies, and I started doing more and more. I became the guy for HGTV, the TV channel, where they do these 1 minute spots where they have, people that go to these different cities in America, and it's usually sponsored by Cadillac or somebody. It says Weekend Getaways brought to you by Ford, you know, or something. Anyway, I was that guy, so I did a lot of those commercials for them, and cool. That was a fun gig. And then I started doing other things, and then as far as the film school thing goes,
because you're doing you're doing the voiceover on your trailers, right?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay. Oh,
no,
okay.
I'm not a voiceover guy.
Maybe you were.
My hillbilly accent wouldn't go for that. No,
sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's cool. But yeah, as far as the film school thing, I didn't go to like an official film school and graduate or anything. However, I was doing a commercial for this perfume company. It was like a national. It was shown in closed circuit mall television, shopping mall televisions. Okay. And the camera guy happened to be moonlighting. He was the second cam op for the TV show Friends. And he was working on the set. And I started kind of hanging around him. And I got more curious. I didn't care about hanging around the actors. They were they were just boring and fake to me. And mm-hmm. I started hanging around the crew. And then I started hanging around the guy. And then we were working on 35mm film. So they had their hands in the tent, the dark tent, and all that stuff. So it was really cool for me. And I just basically learned a lot from him. And then I did another movie later on and just hung around the crew. And I just really kind of learned by being around and, you know, being curious.
So what year did you decide, I'm gonna make a movie?
It was 2008. That was my first movie, and that was when I decided,
And you well, even before, before we even get there, let's go back. But it's you mentioned martial arts already, as I did earlier.
Yeah.
When did you start?
I just want the crowd to know, that whoever's listening, that you brought that up.
Yes, I did. Okay. I did. And I'm bringing it up again, damn it. So where did this come up in your life? When did you get started?
Oh, my whole life. My dad has been a huge Chuck Norris fan since I was a baby, but we had a Tank Sudo studio in my hometown in Arkansas, and I first went to martial arts classes when I was 13, mm-hmm. and I think I got to orange belt, and then which is only the second one, and then I quit, and then in 1994, I got back into taekwondo, which is it's a very similar thing, so just a slightly different discipline, mm-hmm. but they're about the same, and I actually got my first degree black belt from there, and I competed, and, you know, like everyone else did, and, you know, tournaments where you go, it's point fighting, so you with pads on, so mm-hmm. it's not just kumite hardcore full contact thing. It's point fighting with pads, mm-hmm. so but I did that for a while and got a bunch of trophies and all that stuff, and you know, I kind of got out of it when I moved away and stuff, but then I made a movie that was an action movie that had a lot of martial arts in it, and so I got back into it again because of that.
And well, then, and now it's kind of coming full circle. That's what you started. And now you've been doing this, you did a lot of music stuff, which we're going to talk about. You did a lot of film stuff, which we're going to talk about. But now you have a YouTube channel that involves your martial art discipline.
Yeah, it's called Mental MMA. And I started that because I've been an MMA fan ever since, you know, like everybody else did. You know, you rent the UFC 1 video in 1993, 94, and then you're hooked after that. And then Pride came out, and Pride was amazing. And then, you know, Strikeforce and all the other ones that came after that. But yeah, I've been an MMA fan for so long. I'm religious with it. I watch every weigh-in. I watch every fight. If I miss a fight, then I will get a hold of it somehow. And I've been like that for decades now, and I haven't missed anything, you know, all the way from the old days to right now. So, you know, I tried to start this channel a couple of years ago, and I got busy making 3 films in the meantime. So now it's like, you know, I'm done making films for just a little bit, and I really want this channel to go because MMA has been so important to me, and anyone that knows me real close knows that I'm very hardcore with MMA. So
tell me about the channel. I mean, what happens on the channel?
I do different things. I do live play-by-play commentary. Actually, it's play-by-play calling, commentating, almost old school 1950s radio baseball style, you know, mm-hmm. Howard Cosell type stuff. And no one really does that right now. You know, I mean, when you watch it, you have, you know, your you know, John Onyek and Joe Rogan guys who will, you know, they'll commentate, but they're not calling it for every single shot that happens, talking about what the fighter looks like, you know, what the ref is doing, what the crowd
you
is
see
doing.
It. And so they're
And I'm calling this thing so fast. I sound like almost like an auctioneer with a stutter. And I do that. And then I do a show where I talk about hot topics and controversial subjects in MMA. And then I do fighter interviews, show up at events, and I cover live events and things like that. So it's really
in fact, you
everything.
Mentioned before the show that you landed your first official press pass.
Yeah, I did, actually. RUF just gave me one this past weekend, and I went to their event, RUF 38.
That had to be kind of exciting
that
for
was,
you.
Yeah, that was awesome, man. It was a great. I met some great fighters. Everybody there was great. The company was great to work with. The fans were awesome. Man, it was the coolest experience ever to be able to you know sit cage side. I'm on you know, on my left is the you know the doctor that checks them you know before and after the fight, and then on my right is the, you know the corner man of the fighter, and I'm like sitting here between these guys right up against the cage, and it's just amazing, man. It was so cool, and I'm so thankful that they gave me the opportunity.
So, do you see that as being a potential for you to keep doing that?
Oh yeah, yeah. This is my thing, man, and I've been wanting to start this channel for a long, long time. It's been going. I even had a logo and a website and a channel several years ago, and I was making so many movies I just couldn't commit to it. But yeah,
cool. Well, I'm glad to see that you've gotten that off the ground, and obviously, with your passion for it, it's going to turn into some cool things. It'll bleed back into your movie world again. Probably make some more movies revolved around the fight world. Huh?
Well, in 2016, I made a martial arts movie.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
And a lot of martial arts people that know me from this channel don't know about that.
Was that which one was that? Was that Emulator or what was
it? It's called Stealing Sunrise 2 Malibu Trail. It's a sequel, actually.
I remember seeing that title. I did not watch that trailer. That's why I'm confused. But since you just mentioned that, let's go ahead and get into some of the movies that you have made. If I understand from what I read, your first film was References.
That's right. Well, it's the first film I actually made, not the first film I was in, but the first film I made.
That you wrote the screenplay,
yep.
You directed the film,
right.
You acted in the film.
And
you
produced
were probably
it.
The casting director who selected the other actors and actresses.
That's right.
And I felt that for an independent film, again, casting was pretty cool. And, of course, as I look through some of your trailers, I recognize some of the actors that are in our local community, a lot of great people. But I thought in watching the trailer, I was like, it was really, really good. And it was like, this is like a romantic comedy that I really want to see. So I'm definitely going to watch this. And I was reading the reviews as well. And I thought you got great reviews from some cool film websites too. So, you know, hat off to you on your first film, which was quite a while ago. 2008 was that then?
Yes, it was the early fall, late summer 2008.
Okay. Yeah. So what was that like undertaking that? That was probably the biggest video thing you tried to do.
Absolutely it was. Yeah.
What did you learn in that process that you hadn't known before going in?
Almost a lot. What I learned most was doing pre-production because I was by myself doing pre-production. That's the hardest work of a movie, and the second hardest thing is editing. Pre-production and editing are the two hardest things you do in a movie. The acting and directing, that's like eating candy. It's nothing
right.
for me, but it's the pre-production and the editing. That's where all the work is.
Well, what's funny is for me, pre-production and editing are the zero parts.
Everybody has
those
are
just
things.
Natural. You know, I just spit the edit out. And everyone goes, "Wow, where'd you learn to edit?" It's like, I don't know. I've just been messing around. But so that's fascinating. And you do all of that now. And in References, was some of your music in that film as well?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh. It has a great soundtrack by a lot of vocal artists that were in it too. That did it.
Do you recall some of the other artists? Off the top of your head?
Yeah, Mandy Lee, who's a pop artist, she actually did pretty well. She was touring around the West and doing California stuff, opening up for, I think she opened up for Bruno Mars at one point, maybe.
Cool.
But she was on it, and some other local artists that were pretty good, too. One is called Life in Stereo, and one was called a lady named Stephanie Light. She was 15 years old. She was a great singer-songwriter. There's a lot of good people on it.
And through your company, the film was put out by He Said, She Said Productions. Was that started before that film or for that film?
That was started because of the movie, basically. Okay. What happened is I was working on a movie about 3 months before that as just an actor. I was hired as an actor to work on one. And there's a girl that worked on that movie, and it was a second movie we've done together as an actor and, you know, co-star. And we wanted to make her start our own movies because it was just like we were tired of doing, you know, the cheap zombie, you know, blood, no plot movies, you
no
know.
No requirement for
yeah,
the actor.
It was just
know?
Horrible. And there was like F-bombs every other word and for no reason and just, you know, whatever they could do just to get attention. And it's like, we want to make real things. You know, I didn't want to watching, you know, my dad is a big supporter of everything I do, and he religiously watches and listens to everything I do. And, you know, I don't want to make movies where I'm sitting on the couch cringing as he's watching it sitting next to me, you know? So I thought, you know, I'll make my own. And she felt the same way about her and her mom, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we started this thing. We're going to call it He Said, She Said, because we're going to be the co-makers of our movies. Okay. You know, we're going to make our movies together, you know, as friends only, you know?
Right.
And so... she ended up doing other things, and about three weeks into it, maybe two or three weeks into it, she kind of bailed out of the whole film thing. I think she just got tired of all of it. And I've been on my own, you know, since then. So I just kept the name because I like it, and I'm a Kevin Bacon fan.
Okay. Who isn't a Kevin Bacon fan? That's pretty cool. And so so that started then. And did you put a soundtrack out for that film as well?
I've had a soundtrack for every single movie I've done except for one.
Okay. I mean, released CD.
An actual CD or a digital release, either okay. one. But I think they've all been CD releases up until 2017. They've all been CD releases.
And have you found that you've had some success with that? People could
no,
get into it?
No,
you've
not,
just made
not
it available.
Yeah, it's made it available. And it usually after about 3 months and the movie's out, it usually becomes a promotional tool to get people to buy the DVD as a bonus or something. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's pretty cool because I enjoy listening to the soundtracks.
Now, you've been making these movies for, you know, a number of years, a dozen years. Do you handle all of your distribution yourself, all independent? Or
I did up until 2 years ago. Okay. I did all my distribution. I'm horrible at distribution. I'm horrible at marketing. That's the one thing I admit, is I am not good at marketing and distribution and stuff.
You make stuff.
I make stuff. You know, I'm, of course, you know, I sold the DVDs and had them made and all that good stuff. But I got signed with a distribution company 2 years ago, and they have my stuff worldwide on Amazon Prime and all the different countries with captioning. They have it on physical DVD sales through Barnes & Noble, Walmart, Best Buy, some other ones
cool.
too.
For all of the titles so far, they took everything?
They took on all my titles, but not every single title was picked up by every single vendor.
Right.
Like Best Buy might pick up four of my movies, but not three, but then those three may be picked up by Walmart or whatever.
Interesting.
And Amazon Prime had every one of them at one point, and I think there's only one that's not on there right now.
But. Okay. Cool. How's that feel?
It's awesome. But, you know, when you're an independent artist, your contracts are bad because it's not my distributor that does it. It's the vendors that do this.
Right.
They give the shaft to independent artists. Like, for instance, on Amazon Prime.
Right.
If my movie's on Prime and not Amazon rental, there's a difference.
Right.
But on Prime, you get to watch movies for free, right? If you're a member. Well, if you're me, you know, someone independent, then you get paid like 0.5 cents per watch or something like that, and then you got to split that with your distributor, and then you pay taxes, so it's really nothing. And if you're a major studio, then they're going to give you like 15 cents a watch,
right,
which is about 30 times more than what I'm getting.
Right.
So it's kind of cool, because what they do the whole kind of, you know, the local, it's like what clubs and labels do with music bands, and, you know, oh, we're giving you exposure, you know.
Yeah. You get to use our name.
Yeah.
So we feel like you should pay us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's how I feel about it. Even though they're making money off of our
movies. Yeah,
I
think when you're coming up, it's kind of what you're doing. It's a lot of consumers, maybe less and less today, but a lot of consumers don't realize that Amazon Prime Video is a place where creators can just upload their content. And so they think you landed some big deal. And so it legitimizes you as a filmmaker in a lot of people's eyes. So I think that's where they feel like, hey, we're giving you something.
Yeah.
You know, you got our logo on your poster, and, you know, and that should help you. So I think that that's their attitude. Not that I necessarily agree with it, but I understand the position. So let me talk about a film you made that I think is interesting here. Where's the title for it? This is a movie that you set in the 30s and 40s, The Coldest Kiss, that was set in the 1930s and 1940s.
Right.
Now, this was when was that movie made, actually?
2014, spring of 14.
About halfway through your film career. What, was this like your fourth or fifth film?
It was only my second one. I took a long
break. Really? Okay.
Yeah, I took a long break between 2008 and 2014 because I was doing music and music videos.
Okay.
Actually, I've made 7 films in the last 5.5 years.
Okay, that's amazing. Yeah. So we're gonna have to talk a lot more than an hour for me to be happy. I got a lot of questions. But on The Coldest Kiss, first of all, I guess one of the things I was interested in is you tried to pull off on a independent, low to no budget film, I'm assuming, a time period piece. So you had to have old cars and old costumes, locations that would still fly. Did you find that difficult? Was that the most difficult part, or how did you pull that off?
It's difficult to do because of the financial restraints, but it was very fun to do. I'm an old soul. I really don't get along with the 21st century very well. So actually, ever since my first movie references, everything after that has been a period film.
Yeah, it's gone back at least to like the 90s.
That's the latest. Yeah,
this one went back the farthest.
It was set between 1938 and 1947. We had everything you could imagine. And we did everything that was, it was all legitimately period. Right. And everything down to the soda bottles. I even searched out a Mountain Dew bottle from 1947 when it was first, Mountain Dew first came out, and it was a local thing in Kentucky. I found
That's
out.
So cool.
Yeah, we did everything. The clothes were done. All the clothes by the women that they were wearing, and the shoes and purses and hats were made between 1910 and 1948.
You have biplane shots in there. You have a double wing biplane.
We
flying
do.
Through
we
there.
Have it. It's a 1941 Stearman Cadet double winged aircraft, and it was actually used for pilot training in World War II. The very plane we used, and it was refurbished to fly now, but we got to use that in our movie, and our actor actually flew in the cockpit of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Now, you won. That's the film that that won the best feature in the Great Lakes International Film Festival in 2015.
Yeah, and it also was nominated. It's actually gotten more awards than anything we've done, but it was also nominated at the Trail Dance Film Festival in Ron Howard's hometown, at his film festival. He doesn't run it, but it's his hometown's festival. And
London, I think, International?
No, that was festival. It was Duncan.
Oh, okay.
And we did that one, and we were nominated for, I got nomination for Best Director, and there were only three directors nominated out of 1,000 films, and we were nominated for Best Movie, Best Feature, and then I got nominated for Best Actor, and there were a lot of big people in that festival, like famous people that I'm a fan of. But I just think that maybe they were biased to independent actors. They wouldn't give independent actors a spotlight for once, because Eric Roberts was in that, Juliet Lewis was in that.
Great.
Willie Nelson, Mark Hamill from Star Wars guy. I mean, there was so many famous. Gary Cole was in that. If people don't know who Gary Cole is, they ever watch Office Space? He's the boss. Yeah, that guy. But no, there's a lot of good people in it, and we got a lot of nominations over those films, so that was awesome for that.
And in The Coldest Kiss, you won Best Actor in the Jerome Film Festival.
I did. Yeah, I won Best Actor for that in the Jerome Film Festival, which is I still have that award today, and I use it as a I used it as a cameo in my latest movie. Actually, it kind of made a cameo on the table in the background.
That's funny. I do that. My concert posters are in the back walls of stuff. All kinds
of
things.
Proud of that.
It's just it's fun for people who know to catch those things. You know. Well, let me ask you this: when you're writing and you're acting and you're directing, because you do it with an intention of being your film.
That's right.
So does that inhibit what you write, or does it make it easier to write because here's what I want to play?
It's exactly both of those. It's easier because, once again, I know what I'm up against, because when I'm writing a script, I know that I got to produce this. I know I'm directing it, and I know what my limits are, what I'm allowed to do and what I'm capable of doing with my resources.
As an actor, in a sense. Or, oh, okay.
With my resources as a filmmaker.
All right.
And the other side of that is that I feel also restricted, because I want to write a cool scene, but I know I can't deliver on that scene. So I got to make it not as cool, because I can't afford to make it the way I want it. So the script kind of suffers because of my limitations of resources. So it's kind of a little bit of a both, but it also makes it easier because I know what I'm up against.
Well, I think I guess my question is more about just as an actor, not as a filmmaker.
As an actor. No, as an actor, I don't limit myself at all with my characters that I do. The only reason why I make my own movies is because I love to act so much, and it's so fun. I can't find any good roles to, I'm not like in Hollywood or anything. So in Arizona, I don't find a lot of good movies, and people don't really ask me, So I've got to write my own movies if I want to do any acting. So, I write movies that I want to do during time periods that I like, that I enjoy being in. I do got to kind of watch my characters, because it's kind of hard for me to do different accents and things. If you watch some of the movies, every now and then I can talk kind of flat and normal, and I don't have to sound like I'm from Arkansas all the time. I can fake my way through it sometimes.
But it takes a little effort.
It takes effort, so I got to watch what characters I do. So I usually give myself a character that I can kind of be natural with. So, yeah.
Okay. Now, in that same movie, The Coldest Kiss, I read that the score was performed by the Scottsdale Philharmonic Symphony.
That's right.
How much fun was that for you?
That was awesome, but it wasn't as cool as it sounds.
Okay. First of all, who wrote it, or where did it come from?
The movie?
No, the score.
Oh, the score. The score is made of standards performed by the Scottsdale. So a lot of those, a lot of those songs are old classical standards. The music in it. So they didn't actually do the. They performed it, but they didn't compose it.
And they did the, so they didn't necessarily perform it for the film?
No, they did not. They actually performed all those in their concerts, and they were recorded, and they just allowed me to use all the music I wanted from it.
So they licensed it too.
So it was performed by them, but it wasn't written. They didn't compose anything for the movie.
Okay, cool. I haven't seen the film yet, but I read that. I'm like, that had to be cool to be able to sit there while they were playing your score.
It was cool. They just gave me the permission to use the recordings.
Cool. So I had an opportunity to, when a filmmaker in Hollywood came to Phoenix back when I had a recording, big fancy recording studio in town, and he had 30 cues he had to record, and the musicians were on strike in L.A. And so somebody convinced him, one of his friends in Arizona convinced him, our players are good enough, come out here. So we set 20 string players up in the main room of that studio, which we'll tell everybody you're familiar with. We have a history that you pointed out when you walked in.
That's right.
We met before. Yeah. So that's going to be fun to cover. But in that room, we had about 20 string players, and he laid the score out across the console, and we cut all of these cues for this film. And they were all pretty short cues, so we didn't need to watch the film. They would be 3 seconds long, and he knew where they started in the movie, so we didn't have to necessarily time them to picture. So we weren't doing anything to picture. A couple of the longer cues a conductor conducted, knowing the tempo, and that was about it. But it was a lot of fun to hear this incredibly crazy, at sometimes incidental music designed for a scene. Because scoring is an incredibly strange experience, I've found, and it has an awareness of an emotional component that's incredibly important and maybe difficult to connect with all the time. So have you done some scoring like that?
From scratch. You know, I'll watch the visual edit and I'll compose music as I'm looking at it from scratch.
Yeah,
I've
How
done
does that
on
feel?
Most of my films, a lot of my
working.
Films.
How's that? How do you? What's your process?
It's actually it's kind of easy. The process is easy, but you know, it's not so easy coming up with things. But once you get a feel for where the scene's going, it's easy at that point. There was one film score that I didn't do, which is called An Idle Mind is the Devil's Playground. It's a 1960 era black and white Twilight Zone style film, and it actually got a great review from Rod Serling's old writing partner.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he came out of it. He used to write for the LA Times, and he actually hosted a show on ABC with Rod Serling. They were partners, and he was actually his student at Ithaca University or Ithaca College way back in the day. Mm-hmm. But he's still family friends of the Serling family right now. But he hadn't done a review since, I think, the 70s or 80s, and he came out just to do a review on my film. So that was awesome. He said that if Rod Serling were alive today, that he would have approved of the movie. I'm like, wow, I'm a huge Rod Serling fan. But anyway, we did that song. That movie was about it was set in 1960, about a musician who had a fear of contact with people, and he locked himself away in his house. But he was a theremin player. A theremin is an instrument that you know what it is, but for the people that are listening, they might not know. But it's an instrument where it's a wooden instrument that has these bars out of it where you don't actually touch the instrument, but it works off of sound waves, and it gives you all kinds of different things like modulation, pitch, notes, volume, all kinds of stuff. And if anyone ever watched this show, Dark Shadows, or if they've ever listened to the original War of the Worlds, the original one, you know, that ghostly sounding instrument, people going, "Ooh."
It's probably the original Star Trek, right? The TV series, maybe?
Yeah, so anyway, there's a guy named Kip Rosser from Philadelphia or New Jersey. He lives between Newark and Philadelphia, and he's a world-class theremin player, one of the best on the planet. I think he's the fastest player, actually. He's known for that. But he's really good. I called him up, asked him what he, you know, how I could possibly get him to score this movie, because the whole movie is based around a theremin player in the movie, and I don't know how to play a theremin at all. You know, I could fake it with a synth or something, but I wanted the real thing. So I called him to see if he would do the score, and he was up for it. And he did the score from there. And just talked to him on the phone and realizing just more about this guy and watching his video. He has instructional videos on YouTube and stuff. I was like, dude, you're a character yourself. I said, why don't you come here and film this movie as this character? So he came out. He flew out. Never acted before on camera. He came out and blew it away. Now he's known as one of my best actors ever in any of my movies. The guy's awesome. His name is Kip Rosser. Awesome.
What was the name of that film?
An Idle Mind is the Devil's Playground.
An Idle Mind is the Devil's Playground.
And the lead actor was actually a guy who has quite a history in film. He's actually kind of legendary for the movie Breakin', the 80s breakdance movie.
Okay.
He played Franco, the main antagonist of the movie. It's an 80s breakdance movie, and his You know, the guy who plays Christopher McDonald, Shooter McGavin from Happy Gilmore. He's in it with them.
Oh, cool.
And anyway, it's a cool movie. I've always been a fan of that movie. And this guy's a dancer from way back. He danced for he was Olivia Newton-John's choreographer. He was Michael Jackson's go-to guy. Michael Jackson used him for the Thriller video, the Captain EO video, his Disney specials. He danced with Sid Charisse. he coached John Travolta on Staying Alive.
Really?
He choreographed all that stuff. Anyway, the guy's real. He's a big guy in the business, and he's the star of that movie I'm talking about.
Wow! How did you land him?
I got a hold of his agent. He lives in Utah now, and I got a hold of his agent, and he's with an agent there. And I just said, "Hey, you know, what would it take to get Ben Loki in my film? Because I just knew he'd be perfect for it. You know, because he's older now, and he'd be perfect." And she told me, you know, kind of what I need to do, and she forwarded my information and everything about the script. You know, everything I had on it, my promo trailer I made, the script, the whole deal. And he was all up for it, so it was pretty good. And he went above and beyond to help make it happen too. So.
Cool, man! I have to check that one out too. This is exciting. It's gonna be a lot of good movies to watch. Now, if somebody wants to watch some of this stuff, what's the easiest way instead of trying to remember or write down all these titles?
They don't have to write anything down. If they just go to my website,
which is
hesaidshesaidproductions.com.
Okay.
He said, she said productions. That is like a hub for everything I'm doing. And it's not only just my movies, but it has all of my music albums on there, and it has my mental MMA channel on there. So, and it has everything. It's so easily laid out. It's very simple. If you just go to hesaidshesaidproductions.com, it has my entire life on there, everything I'm doing.
All right. Well, listen, before we go into your music career, and I still want to talk about another one of your films, which is the one that kind of how I ran into you and started checking you out. Let's go ahead and play one of your songs and give you a break here. Let you get a glass of water. I have two cuts to play. You tell me which one you'd like me to spin. The Devil Wants or She's Digital?
Let me see. Let's start it off a little bit more serious, and we'll get more fun toward the end. How's that?
Okay.
Okay, we'll start with The Devil Wants.
And where did this come from? Is this on in one of the films, or is it just on one of the records?
No, it's on one of my albums that I made.
Now, is this...
I got a music video for it, too, actually. There's a music video for it.
Okay, cool. And the song is simply called The Devil Wants.
The Devil Wants.
Now, who is the artist on the song? Because you go by...
I have two artists.
Right, you have
band.
A group?
I have a band that I call Official Version.
Right.
The band is called Official Version. And then I also have a separate project to do where I use an alter ego name, Adrian Starr.
Yeah.
And that's my 80s project where I do legitimate 80s produced music and music videos, where if you want to see me look and sound completely 80s, it's Adrian Starr. But Official Version is my contemporary modern.
Okay. And so who's doing this cut?
This one is Official Version Modern.
Okay,
modern
cool.
Project.
So Official Version produced by Michael Jason Allen here on the ROD show.
Yeah.
I'm
just going to say I wrote and performed it without a studio on that. This one,
all by yourself.
Yeah,
all on your
right.
own. That's how good you are. You just do it all.
Yeah.
I know. That's the way it is. I love it. Here we go. Check it out.
Thank you.
listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
Brought to you by the third annual Fervor Music Biz Summit. Christy Spencer from Fervor Records and top LA music clearance experts Susie Berry and Matt Lilly will explore all aspects of the complex world of music rights clearance. Matt and Susie's credits include Orange is the New Black, American Gods, Mad Men, The Righteous Gemstones, and the new AMC Network series, Dispatches from Elsewhere. The third annual Fervor Music Biz Summit is April 4th in the main auditorium at the Glendale Library. Information is on the web at fervormusicbizsummit.com. That's fervormusicbizsummit.com.
And that was The Devil Wants from Official Version here on the Auto D Show, where my guest is Michael Jason Allen, singer-songwriter, producer of the band. And I've seen some of the videos, Jason, and there's this pretty girl in those videos, too. Who's that?
Oh, that's Gucci Mercer.
Gucci Mercer.
Uh-huh.
There's a name.
Yeah.
So what's her role in the band?
Well, her first role is she's my lady.
Well, there you go.
In the Official Version, she does the synthesizers and bass stuff on synths live.
Mm-hmm.
And then helps with the music videos and things like that.
And yeah. I believe I saw her name in one of the film credits as well.
She helps out in a lot of the films too. In fact, she's my right hand person. Anything that you know I'm not doing, she's doing. You know, mm-hmm. So even camera. Even
so, has she been acting in some of the films as well?
She does. She's not really into acting that much, mm-hmm. but she does cameos and things. You know, especially when I need them. You know,
I need an extra who comes in and just says this.
She'll jump in and do some stuff. Actually, in the newest movie, I just finished Yancey McCord, the killer that Arizona forgot about. She was actually my co-host on it, so that was a big role for her. She was actually a lead.
Okay, so. Now let's talk about that film, because that is how I found you.
Okay.
Somehow I saw a link or someone had posted something about that story. So I went, I stumbled onto that trailer, watched the trailer, and again, recognized actors, you know. Mark Spino, I think, was...
Yes, he was in that.
Doing the kind of the MC, you know.
He was kind of the on-camera narrator.
Yeah, narrator presenting the story. And then this is where, you know, I mentioned in social media you were a detective, and I didn't mean to imply that you worked for the police force in any degree, but you did a bunch of detective work here. And watching the trailer, it's like, oh my gosh, did they find this guy? And what happened? And I've never heard this story. So give me the overview of Yancey McCord, and then tell me kind of how you came about this story.
Okay, so I usually do... like fictional, you know, feature films.
Mm-hmm.
But this one right here is a documentary. I'm not used to doing these types of films. But there's a town called Kindred. It's a ghost town. There's about 100. I didn't realize this. There are more than 100 ghost towns in Arizona.
Wow.
And you can go driving around and there's a list on online. And there's all these different towns, and you'll see remnants of them all over Arizona that, you know, they're not functioning anymore. Most of them are because of mines, you know, that mm-hmm. were used back then. But this one's called Kindred, and in 1961, a guy named Yancey McCord killed a whole family of 7 people in one home at once, in one morning. And 16 hours later, he left town, and after he was taken in and questioned, he somehow got out of he left. They don't know if he escaped or if he was let go, because the constable of the town was his friend, kind of. They kind of knew each other. So
he said, "You better get out of town, Yancey."
No one had seen her. Yeah, no one had seen, and no one's seen or heard from him since. Here it is, you know, 60 years later, 59, mm-hmm. 60 years later, and no one's heard from him since. And so we interviewed Lieutenant Governor Nicholas Hisman. That was a Lieutenant Governor. It's not in the early 80s, and they don't have any record of. They brought the case to him, but they didn't have enough information to investigate or prosecute anyone, or even try to look for Yancey. So the whole thing was that, you know, he's basically the killer that Arizona literally forgot about. He kind of just slipped through the cracks, and that was it, you know. And the town didn't report it. They didn't get, you know, state police or federal police in, because there was a small little town, kind of like Little House on the Prairie style, where they have their own law, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They do everything. They take everything into their own hands, and they don't want outsiders coming in. You know, because once you have something like that, the news comes in, the cops come in, and all of a sudden your town is basically it's under surveillance, it's being policed by outside, you know,
mm-hmm.
Agencies and stuff. So they just thought they'd handle it themselves, but it never got handled. So I wanted to find out what happened.
Well, did you find out what happened?
I did find out what happened, absolutely. And the movie just came out a month. We had the premiere a month ago at the theater. And
maybe that's why, yeah. I came across my computer screen. Somebody was sharing that event.
Yeah, because it was shared around a little bit, and we just had the premiere a month ago at the theater over there. Actually, what's funny is we did it at the premiere right next to the MMA Lab, which is a mixed martial arts gym in town that has a lot of great fighters in it, mm-hmm. and we premiered our film right next door to it.
Now, who's in that film? Because obviously you've got... You mentioned that you and Gucci are in it, so you guys are playing
we're the hosts.
Yourselves.
We're just ourselves.
But there's
the
some reenactments in the film, I imagine.
There are some reenactments, and there are some interviews and things like that. We had interviews with people who were actually there at the time, who lived there, and family members of some of the victims were there, and politicians who were around at the time, and the realtor who ended up in the 90s selling the whole town, selling all the lots in that town where it's a ghost town now, but she ended up selling all of it as a realtor from Tucson. We got a lot of people involved in this.
Mm-hmm. And was there, I think you mentioned to me that there was a name actor in there too.
Yeah, he was helping out with, he played a big role in helping this film out on camera. His name is Chris Robinson, and he was known for playing Dr. Rick Weber on General Hospital for a long time, for many years. Okay. He was Luke and Lara's dad, you know. And he was on a million things. He was on so many things. He was on a show. It was actually his show. He was the star of the show for 3 years called 12 O'Clock High. He was on Alfred Hitchcock Hour, a lot of episodes of that. He was on, I can't even think of everything. Mm-hmm. The Donna Reed Show. I mean, he has been around. This guy's been around. He was on Chips. He was on Murder, She Wrote.
Does he, everything. In this film, does he play Yancey?
He plays a reenactment of Yancey.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's interesting. Yeah, I really, you know, in fact, I asked you before the show started what happened, and you're like, I'm not going to tell you. You got to go watch the movie.
That's right. I don't want to ruin it for you or anyone else. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's really cool, and we'll have to check that out. Let me ask you this too: is there anything before I just go through? I don't really have time to go through all the other films, but like Emulator or Hello, Are You There? Is there anything in particular you'd like to share about those films that made them different for you, or what?
Yeah, they're just all period films. Emulator was set in 2003. That's the latest of my period films, like to now, and that's basically about a killer who went to prison in 1950s for being a serial killer. And while he's in prison, he gets a degree where he helps people to not be, you know, bad people, to become good. He gets a psychology degree, a teacher degree, and the cops start going to him for advice while he's in prison. And then they let him out after 50 years so he can help them catch more criminals, and also to teach, you know, young kids not to be criminals. And when he gets out, it gets all over the news. And then this guy is watching the news, and he gets obsessed with him, and he tries to copycat him. And when he does, they don't know if the old serial killer started his stuff again, or if the new guy is, if they have a copycat. So they hire him. They hire the old guy to catch his own copycat killer, who's mm-hmm. active right now. So that's what that's about. Next one, Hello, Are You There? That was set in 1989. It actually goes all the way back to the 1909, actually. It's about an old 1909 crank telephone. Okay. And it's found by a guy who his dad dies, and he finds it in the cellar, and he hangs it up as a decoration. He restores it, and it starts ringing, and people are calling through it, but it's not his dad. It's these kids from the 50s, these teenagers from the 50s, like doo-wop style kids. They had a crash by the house, and they're trying to contact each other, and they both keep getting a hold of the phone, but they can't talk to each other, the boy and the girl who died in the crash. And this guy, in 1989, he's their connection somehow. So I don't want to tell any more than that. But yeah.
Now, you wrote these stories.
Yeah.
That's absolutely fascinating, man. That's amazing.
Yeah, actually, I do it really quickly, too. I think I'm the fastest screenplay writer I know. My screenplays,
for example, how long would one of them take you?
My screenplays, on average, when I come up with the story, from the time I sit down and start the first word or the title to I put the end, is about 2 to 3 days.
Wow. That's amazing.
Because I kind of talk to myself as I'm writing it, and sometimes I type pretty fast. I mean, I type about 40 to 45, you know, words a minute, you know, but I can't type as fast as my mind is going. So I'll get out my voice recorder, and I'll start doing like this Norman Bates thing where I'm using three different voices to do the scene, and then I just type it as soon as I'm done talking, and that's it. I don't dwell on a line for like 30. You remember Throw Mama from the Train Billy Crystal sitting there, and he's like, the night was moist.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the night was
He picked
wet.
Every word.
The night,
finally.
Yeah, every word. He never gets it done. Yeah, I'm just not that guy. I just let it go and just whatever happens.
Uh-huh. Wow. Well, let me ask you this then. Would you say that when you're on the set that often dialogue changes? Because you're not married to it. You're just kind of I just want the thing to go through the store. So
that's a great question, and it has exactly two opposite answers. One is that I'm a stickler for verbatim on set, is because I do period films, and there's a certain language in the way they talk, and a lot of actors today, they can't replicate that, especially when they get in the moment. They start talking like they do now, saying you know, they use sayings and even vocal fry, you know, like girls do.
Yeah.
And they'll change things around, and it doesn't sound as period as the script does. So I kind of have to keep it legitimate to the script, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But this newest movie, Yancey McCord, The Killer That Arizona Forgot About, is exactly the opposite, where I just told the people that were helping out or the people that were reenacting interviews, I just told them, you know, I said, hey, this is the story. This is what happened. This is the information that went on. And say it in your own words any way you want to, mm-hmm. because it was now. It was set in 2020, so they can talk any way they want. So I just let them have the freedom, and it turned out really great.
Cool. I can't wait to see that, too. So there's a bunch of films I'm going to watch, and then we have got about another 7 or 8 minutes. I want to play one other song, but before we do, you had mentioned to me that we had met years and years ago at my old studio because your brother was in there.
Yeah, back in 2003.
Yeah, Aaron Von Allen.
Aaron Von Allen, yeah, a musician. He did an album, and it was recorded, and it was engineered and mixed at your studio, and then he took it to Capitol Records, and it was mastered over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think probably Jameson Weddle was the guy recording.
Jamie was the producer on it, yeah. And the engineer, and yeah. I think he did the mixing on it too, and yeah. Then it was mastered by Dave Schilecki at Capitol.
Right.
Yeah, and then you were actually on the sessions, yeah. Too, on some of those A-Room sessions.
Yeah, I remember Aaron coming in and working, tall, skinny kid. And what's funny
is he's still the same tall and skinny, exactly.
And when you mentioned that to me, I was like, oh my gosh, I think that's a vibe I got from talking to you on the phone and from watching you on the trailers. And so when you said that, I said, of course, you just like him. I mean, you remind me a lot of him, you know, that you mentioned that. But so let's play this other song of yours called She's Digital.
She's Digital, yeah.
Now, is this one an Adrian Starr tune?
No, it's not an Adrian
Starr
tune.
Okay, this is another official version.
I didn't bring any Adrian Starr music because I didn't know people would. Yeah, if people's in the 80s and they want legitimate 80s look and sound. Yeah,
on new songs.
Yeah, on my website, hesaidshesaidproductions.com, you'll see my Adrian Starr project. You're going to freak out.
You're talking just about as fast as I do, so say the name of the website one more time,
He Said, slower. She Said Productions.com.
Okay, great. So one last track. This is called She's Digital from official version here on the Auto D Show. Check it out. He says, as it slips away, and it's coming back. Here we go.
Every day you see her.
listening to Auto D, coming at you live.
And that was She's Digital from Official Version here on the Auto D Show. Another nice track, Jason. Very cool.
Thank you.
And are you playing everything on it then?
Yeah, everything on there is synth-driven, and the drums actually were played by a drummer I had, but they were electronic drums. They were played on drum pads.
Okay, so. Cool. And female vocal in there with you?
Female vocals was a girl. Oh, my gosh, I forgot her name. She came in. She was the sister of the guy who was engineering that day.
That's cool.
I forgot her name.
That's a cool way to get on a record.
I've only met her that one day, and that was it.
Okay. Well, you you mentioned that you just put a video out. So what you got coming up?
A music video, yeah. My Adrian Star, it was an Adrian Star video. It's like an 80s old school Grandmaster Flash, LL Cool J rap type song, and called Funky Cash. And that's on my website as well. Everything's on my website. But yeah, that's on there. It was my 80s Adrian Star project, and we just finished that. I'll be filming another 80s video next month for another one of my songs. And other than that, I'm doing my Mental MMA show, because that's what I'm focused on right now. It takes a lot of work to do it, and that's what I'm in, mm-hmm. in right now.
Cool. Well, man, our time is up. Thanks so much for coming down and sharing all this with me. I can't wait to watch these films.
Awesome.
We'll stay in touch, and I'll give you my thoughts. I'm sure that not going to be necessarily relevant, but I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Thanks, man, for having me on. I appreciate it very much.
All right, man. Take care.